Coming to you from the City of the Weird. Exploring topics from the esoteric and unexplored to dimensions unknown. Shining a light of truth on the darkest corners of our reality. Welcome to the Curious Realm.
Well, hello, everybody, and welcome to this very special pre-recorded episode of The Curious Realm. Thank you so much for tuning in. Thank you so much to our good friends at Cygames International. We had a great time there last week. We hope you enjoyed all of our coverage. That was an amazing event. We have some great guests for you tonight. As always, even though we are pre-recorded, it is new content. Never repeat or best of content with us, so... Our guest in the second segment, we are joined by our good friend, Anne Celine. We will be talking about her work and blogs, things like that, when it comes to paranormal, when it comes to looking at evidence in the paranormal, when it comes to how we experience the paranormal and what those experiences are, what they may be rooted in. In the first segment here, I think we're going to be talking... some deep stuff in this first segment, something that we've talked about for a long, long time on this show. Welcome back to the show, our good friend Mike Turber. We will be talking about Tic Tac UFO technology, something that we've talked about with Mike for many years now. And not only that, but the idea of a lot of the stories that we hear in the media being actual cover for actual programs going on, which is something that we've talked about regularly. Mike, welcome back to the show. How are you today?
Sure, I've been worse, but I'm here and that's a good thing. As long as I'm breathing, I'm happy.
That's right. That's right. And, you know, this has been, this is specifically the Tic Tac story is something that you and I have been on since right at the beginning, man.
We went straight from Las Vegas right to Nimitz and Tic Tac. So yeah. it was like the transition was right there.
Well,
same time frame.
It was because it was right up against the Route 91 shooting in Vegas. That is where we met you from our good friend Shannon Ray Caffey. And within months of that happening, Lou Elizondo went on to CNN with the famed Tic Tac videos from the USS Nimitz experience.
Exactly. Yeah, October 1st was Las Vegas, and then you had December 16th. That was when the New York Times article hit and TTSA was formed. And in between those two events, we had QAnon, which I was involved in on that as well, in that investigation, and that was fun. But I couldn't get on the UFO stuff fast enough because I was so deeply entrenched. You know, I'm working with 65 attorneys on the Las Vegas thing. It took me a while to ramp up the speed to get to where I needed to be and at the level I needed to be to get the information to actually do anything. But then it started snowballing, and I got information that no one else had. And it took 6 years to finally be vindicated on a couple pieces, which you're going to reveal today for the first time.
Well, and you know, something that we, a couple things that we have been revealing for a while now, is number one, the patent for the F-16, F-18, countermeasures laser pod, which is basically a forward-looking infrared laser that allows a system to project an object the size of a plane, really any size, size of a plane or larger, hotter than a plane. The idea is instead of deploying bits of aluminum into the air or chaff, that they would be using
flares,
something like that, that could cause other issues, environmental things, all kinds of stuff. Also, just the fact of how much it costs. Every time you fire something off, it costs tens of thousands of dollars. Whereas if you have a reusable system that you can project an enemy in the air, then the homing missile will follow that instead of the plane. Now, we have said since the very get-go, Mike, people's experience notwithstanding, this is nothing against Kevin Day, this is nothing against Fravor, anything like that. But the fact that every one of those videos is pretty much from a forward-looking infrared pod.
Correct.
Really does put into play the fact of we may be looking at the use of a technology that was burgeoning right at the time of these things. This this was declassified within a year or so of those experiences out on the water during those training maneuvers. So the idea that, A, this may have been a weapons test, which is something that we've said for quite a while.
We finally have proof of that now.
Well, and let's start getting into that, because once again, one of the things that has been said by whistleblowers is that specifically the Tic Tac technology is in numerous generation at this point. And with that comes the fact of it looked like the Tic Tac, but now it is in standard platform, that it's been changed to standard platform. And that is one of the other things that we bring up from our knowledge vault all the time. And what we're showing you folks is things directly from our knowledge vault. Feel free to follow along, curiousrealm.com/knowledge. It'll take you to the declassified programs and docs page. You can select that. Right now we're looking at the Lockheed Martin mini reactor. And you can see that this patent went through in 2018. This is for an injected reactor that is large enough to fit inside of an F-16 platform.
Yep.
So this was 2018 that this patent was filed, which means they were working on it, things like that, way before that.
In 2013, I think that the initial video came out, and I was there. 2014? It was 2013, 2014. I was at Skunk Works or something unrelated. All of my trips to Skunk Works, by the way, not one of them was for the Tic Tac. It was always for something else.
Yeah.
But in the interim of being there, you know, you talk to people. And of course, you're compartmentalized, and they're not really allowed to talk about what they're doing in one department versus another department, even if they're under the same roof. Yeah. They literally, you know, couldn't do that. But you start picking up things and you start realizing, okay, this is going to be an ongoing thing of trying to piece together this puzzle. And sometimes you get the pieces of the puzzle wrong, which I did. I wholeheartedly admitted the very first couple of reports I did was wrong. But then once it finalizes and gets together and then it comes out to the public, as what we'll, I sent you the video earlier of what Tim Phillips had to say, it pieces this together in such a way that it now makes sense. And now I'm at the point where I can finish up the documentary about the three videos and wrap it up and confirm some things for other people as well, because I'm not the only person that was, you know, looking into this. But at the same time, you know, I made some bold claims way back in the beginning.
Yes, that, you did.
You know, people laughed at me.
Yes, yeah, they did.
People laughed at me and made a lot of fun of me. And now I feel vindicated.
I've been right there with you. We've towed the same line the whole time. And that is that I do not doubt one bit that, A, this was a training exercise that nobody there knew about. That explains why tapes were taken, things like that.
Yep.
You know, testing systems that aren't really fully launched yet, but we're at that point. And I just pulled up, actually, the Lockheed Martin Skunk Works video. So let's play that real quick, just so you folks can see it. Before I take it full screen, this is actually from Lockheed Martin's page. This was posted 10 years ago. It is titled Lockheed Martin Compact Fusion Research and Development.
Yep.
Hold on. We're having a little bit of a technical issue. Let me make sure that my audio is going where it needs to.
Yeah, I couldn't hear it.
Oh, goodness. If it doesn't show, we'll narrate it. What they're showing.
Yeah, okay.
I don't know why it's not coming through. Anyway,
the audio is not coming
what they're
through?
Showing, Thomas McGuire is sitting here and he's talking, an MIT engineer working with Lockheed Martin. This is branded with Skunk Works, all kinds of stuff. And the reactor is actively behind them. This is 10 years ago, if you look at that reactor. That is maybe about the size of maybe a one-car garage. It would fit inside of a one-car garage.
Yeah.
So that's 10
years
ago.
And the advantage to that is... Yeah, the advantage to that was not necessarily the size so much, was the fact that they could re-prototype it so fast.
That's right.
Because you can't take the tokamak and build one and then it not work exactly as planned and then build another one shortly thereafter. These things, they could build one every 6 months.
It was three generations a year.
Yeah, exactly.
Was what they said in the video, was that they could 2 to 3 generation this every year. And yep. By the time this program was finished, he would need another job. This kid's like 27 years old, something like that, you know.
Yeah.
So by and this they, point, they did literally, he's got another job.
Yeah, he does. And they I think 2019 or 2020, I was there when they had finalized a lot of that program. And he took a picture outside, and of course, no one could talk about it. But there was a picture that was taken outside at the front of all the program leads that was a part of it. And the person taking the picture at the time was a person that was in the program. I said, "Give me the damn camera and get in the shot." So I ended up taking one of those pictures. I'm not sure which one they released, but whichever one it was that had everybody in it, that would have been the one I took the picture. But it gets to be. After a while, when you start looking back and you start realizing, okay, these pieces of the puzzle will come together, and you kind of back then would hope that it would have been much faster. But one of the key pieces of the puzzle was, as it relates to Nimitz, was who were the people that came on board the Princeton and took that data? And that was an important key for me, because I knew who the people were. I just couldn't come out with the proof, because you're not going to walk out the door with a piece of paper that says that you know this person from this base is who did it. But I went ahead and went on a couple of podcasts back then, and yours included, and I think Jim Breslow's and Michael Sala's, which. He actually printed the whole thing, word for word of everything I said on his page. And I made mention that DARPA was the people that came on board and took the data, them and what hasn't been released to the public yet, and Tim Phillips, I don't think even knows, was that the other two people that were on board that were in somewhat uniform, that they were Air Force Research Laboratory people. So you had, two from DARPA, you had two from the Air Force. They came on board, went inside the captain's quarters, explained to him what's going on, and they went, and that's when Kevin Day and some of the other guys, and some guys didn't see this happen, but the guys that did see it happen remember, plain as day, that these guys came on and took the data, because that's just not something that happens.
That's right. That's right. It's not a normal, it's not an SOP, not standard operating procedure. I managed to get the audio for that video. So let's watch that minute and a half video real quick, Mike Turber. And I'm going to bring it up before I start it, just so everybody can see the Skunk Works logo.
There you go.
The happy music.
Years ago, when people were super excited about nuclear power, we tried to put it on everything, including airplanes. There were some big operational issues that wasn't safe. Fusion is a much safer option, a next generation of airplanes that doesn't rely on fuel and can just stay
airplanes,
aloft, unlimited
airplanes.
Range, unlimited endurance. That's what nuclear fusion can do for an airplane. So nuclear fusion is the process by which the sun works. If you take a gas and you heat it up, eventually it separates into its ions and electrons. When the ions get hot enough, they can overcome their mutual repulsion and collide, fuse into one piece. When they do that, they release a lot of energy, a million times more powerful than a chemical reaction, for example. What we're trying to do is control that reaction here on Earth. We put it in a magnetic bottle that can contain the high temperatures. You need hundreds of millions of degrees. We can release in a controlled fashion that energy. We think we have a very robust strategy going forward that has potential for success. What this concept does is it's a high beta concept, which means we use a high fraction of the magnetic field pressure. We use all of its potential. And that means we can make our devices 10 times smaller. So instead of something the size of a building, we have something the size of a large truck.
That was 10 years ago, folks.
The small is the reason we can do this quickly. If something's small, you can build up momentum, you can develop it fast. It doesn't take 5 years to design it, it takes 3 months. We can design it, build it, test it in under a year. We can do several of these cycles, and we think we can get to a prototype in 5 years. Every time you do plasma physics, you learn something new. And that's why this is a high-risk, high-payoff endeavor. That's what we're doing here, is testing that concept out to see if it really holds the promise that it appears to. And as a defense company, our increasing mission is to enhance global security, and this is how we do that in the energy realm. The world already does 40 gigawatts of gas turbines a year. The gas line going into that gas turbine, we're going to replace that with a heat exchanger coming off our fusion reactor. We basically use the gas turbine infrastructure completely. We partner with one of those companies, and we ship fusion-powered turbine plants around the world, and we expand that technology. Gas turbines are a huge improvement over other technologies in terms of climate change, but they're only a 50% improvement. We take it all the way. So no emissions, safe operation, proliferation-free. That means we can ship it to the whole world with a good conscience. Now, the old promise of atoms for peace was a noble one, but ultimately flawed because the technology wasn't right for it. We can achieve that grand vision and bring clean power to the world. The true atomic age can start. 10 years, we have great military vehicles. 20 years, we have clean power for the world. This isn't online by 2100. This is online by the time I can't even retire after we finish this. No, I still have to find another job after this is done.
And what is funny, once again, you look at the shape of... There's that Skunk Works logo.
Yeah. Love so that pretty. Logo.
But you look at the shape of that reactor behind him, Mike. You look at the shape of the reactor in this patent, and
it looks like the fuselage of a certain plane, doesn't it?
Well, it doesn't just look like that. It also looks like all you would have to do is put a pill capsule around it.
Yeah.
And it's a Tic Tac. That's it. Like, round the corners of that thing. Nothing more. And it's a Tic Tac. So, the idea that this is the technology that we saw burgeoning at that time. This is the kind of technology that we saw on display. Let's get
and
into
you're
that.
Right. One of the key points we have to keep the caveat here to everyone listening is that at this point, unless we can 100% verify something, a lot of this sometimes ends up being a black project that's being, you know, whitewashed with some other,
that's right,
you know, program or disinformation that's given to us, and, you know, for, in one form or another, and it's not on purpose. Sometimes it's just sometimes, you know, a person in compartmentalization of department A doesn't know what person B is doing in compartmentalization compartment B, and you just have to take everything with a grain of salt until you get actual verifiable information, which slowly but surely over time we've gotten, and don't call me Shirley, but we'll piece it together eventually and come out with the right thing. And that's kind of what happened here, is a classic example, because I can't think of any UFO experience that's happened in the last 20 or so years that could possibly take on the monumental achievements that the Nimitz encounter has taken on. It's just that one event. And so what I had to do in looking at it is I had to separate the event into its constituent parts and then tie them together only if there was something to make them tie it together. And once I did that, I started getting to the point where I could actually determine what Fravor saw, what Kevin Day saw. And I've been in talks with Kevin Day almost daily for months now. And then going, you know, beyond that into the Roosevelt and what happened there, and talking to, I can't say his name. Well, unless I get permission, I won't say his name. We'll just say that a very high up person in Mercury Systems, the people that make the DRFM technology, which is partly responsible for a lot of what was seen with Roosevelt, and not so much with Nimitz. A lot of people don't realize also, the Nimitz was, you know, not the only aircraft carrier group that was in that area. A lot of people aren't aware of it, but the Ronald Reagan had just been basically commissioned, and it was also doing its training in the same area. Yeah. But you never hear anyone say anything about that. There's a reason for that, and that'll come out down the road as well. But I have an image on November 16th, which is 2 days after the event, of the Nimitz right next to the Ronald Reagan. I'll send that over to you, so you'll have that. You know, but how does that play out? It basically means that there are two ships in the area that had a lot of radar components that were being tested, and a lot of different things were being tested. And the month before, something else that people don't realize was they were running a program called project called Silent Hammer. And Silent Hammer tested a lot of new technology as well. And at the end of that, the reason why the Air Force was involved was because the Ohio-class submarines were converted over to Tomahawk launching missile launching subs instead of Trident launching subs. And that being the case, you got to see a lot of new technology that was ran by other armed forces. So if you ever hear about the Air Force being on submarines, that's basically where it started. And it's just not something you see every day that the Air Force would be on a submarine, but when it comes to the Ohio class, that's, when it started. So, it's going to be a lot to unpack. You know, we're going to have several shows over the next few months to unpack all of this, but the end result is going to be that we now know what the three videos were, what they weren't, and also essentially what the amounts to what technology was being tested at the time. Well, we actually know the name of the program.
Well, and we'll get into that, but before we do, idea that once again, that stories, scuttlebutt, rumors, things like that are actively used on purpose. That when people say, oh, well, I heard this happen within communities, they will actively take that story, bloom it, water it, everything else, if it is something that will help covertly attain the goal that they are trying to attain when it comes to production of material, things like that. You know, it's not an uncommon practice when it comes to the world of literal disinformation. We have an office of disinformation that exists since we struck down the Smith-Mundt Act.
And there are people that eat that stuff up. If the government says, look over here, I'm not going to be looking anywhere that they tell me to look. I'm going to be looking either totally opposite. I'll glance over there for a minute just to see what's up. But for the most part, that's why when I went to Skunk Works, and I was able to video that one time. I mean, they allowed me to do video, which is, I don't know of anyone that's ever been allowed to video their trip to Skunk Works. But they let me do it. And while I was there, I got to video the buildings and stuff and tell people what was going on. Hang on just a second. I got somebody pulling up.
Yeah. Uh-oh. Now, whenever you think about this stuff, folks, whenever you start bringing it together, whenever you start looking at these things, because once again, and Mike Turber will be right back with us, it's interesting when you start breaking down the fact that there are programs that have been going on, once again, for decades now. The idea of these micro reactors being fit into, because once again, the idea that they have said, there's Mike. You there, Mike? Oh, did we lose him? Is he there?
Yeah.
There he is.
Yeah.
All right. But like I was just telling the audience, the idea that these programs have been used to mask other stuff, you know, the idea that these stories have been used to mask programs like the reactor patent from Lockheed Martin. Things also from them. The patent for the laser induced plasma for infrared homing missile countermeasure. So that's 2020. The other is 2018. Those are back to back patents just about. And when you start looking at their dates of publication, when you start looking at their dates of when they came to public knowledge, that's right up around and after when the Tic Tacs started coming out. So the idea that this technology was then, that the story was planted, the story was there, these are actual technologies, and then slowly and quietly in the background, 3 years later, 5 years later, these patents are released and put out. So it doesn't really like, most people's memories don't go back that far. They don't span that back that far with random connection of fact, stuff like that. So the idea that these things were released in that kind of way on purpose, you know, and yes, okay, well, let's follow the sight line and the zeitgeist of what's going on and utterly use this.
Well, here's something that's weird that you may or may not be aware of, and I can reach out to the listeners too. If anyone figures out the reason for this, let me know. I'll try to figure it out as well. Just recently, one of the patents that Sal Payas had done, you know, it's five famous patents that if any one of them, you know, came to fruition and into an actual working tangible object, would earn him a Nobel Prize. I mean, you know, he's got three of them, basically three Nobel Prizes would be awarded to him if this came through. But one of the patents, the maintenance fee was not paid on it, and the patent has lapsed.
Oh, wow.
That to me is a big, I really would like to know the story behind that, because it doesn't make a lot of sense. The patents are, you can't put a patent in, you have to put a patent in the inventor's name. So it's in Sal Payas's name. But I'm wondering, you know, if there's some backstory to that we may or may not be aware of or interested in or may not be privy to. So one of the three has to happen, and I want to find out which one it is and see what's going on with that. That'll be an interesting story right there.
Well, you know, and especially whenever you start looking at a lot of the, I'm bringing up a few of the articles that we have and the abstracts that we have on the website right now regarding Pius and the ideas of, you know, magnetic fields, Froning quantum vacuums, Alcubierre warp drive. These are all things that propulsion for future flight, designs for gravitational wave generators. These are all things that are out there that have come out within the last few years.
Yeah, and the big one, the transmedium craft that's, you know, able to go, you know, through space, air, and water, like it's not even there. So,
yeah,
all of these things, any one of them would be a lifetime's worth of work for one person to have five patents that are just absolutely on prima facie, just the singular version would be a lifetime of work, and he has five. It's amazing. But of course, he's backed by the Navy at the time. He was working at Patuxent, the laboratory there. So there's a hidden story here that you and I both are on the cusp of you know, wanting to know the insider information. I get some, you get some, and between the two of us, we start figuring things out. You know, and hopefully they turn out to be true. And you know, sometimes it takes a year or so, and in one of the cases, it's taken almost 7 years.
Well, you know, this is one of the things that, and people ask me all the time, Mike, whenever I talk to them, whenever I'm at conferences like the one that I'm going to, hey, Cygames, can't wait to see you. It's one of those, man, it's hard not to get carried away. It's hard not to go down rabbit holes. I tell people all the time, I will never play Nostradamus with you. ever. I'm not going to give like a hard date. You know, I'm not going to give a hard definition of, I will give and I will always say, and it's some of that's because of my past broadcast background, Mike. I'm not going to make those statements of absolute.
I know.
You know,
I've done the same.
I will always caveat the fact of, this is my educated opinion. This is where my investigation has led me. This is where the facts have led me to believe. Make up your own mind. I am here to just present facts. There's a reason why the color of this show is purple. It's not only the crown chakra, but it's also politically neutral. So the idea of politics pushing this, the idea of, you know, administrations keeping this data in the background, because I don't think we're going to get, with Big D disclosure, Mike, we are not going to get a Houdini moment. We aren't going to get a gurney wheeled out into Congress with a sheet on it. You know,
but there are those moments that do come up periodically that, and I'll be honest with you, when I get emotional, when I almost like Kevin Day does. Kevin Day gets emotional too. Me and him on the phone together sometimes. And I sit there and I say something, knowing I'm going to be ridiculed, knowing that, you know, I sometimes I'll go against the grain, sometimes I go with the grain. It just it really depends on the situation. But then in the end, I want to make certain that what I present is as factual as I can. And if it's me, you know, not even taking a guess, it's an educated guess or me giving out my best idea of what I think something is at the time, is one thing. But when something comes out and finally I'm completely vindicated, just like someone that's in the position to know, and we're not talking about just someone that worked at DARPA. We're talking about the head of DARPA said this. And when the head of DARPA says this and verifies what I said was true 6 years after the fact, he can't replace the 6 years of ridicule that I got, but It does make me feel good, and I went straight into tears, man. It was like, holy crap. Thank you for that, and I appreciate it. And Mick, I have to give Mick West the kudos for that as well, because I have to credit him for getting the interview with Tim Phillips to get that information. And when it came out, somebody said, hey, you need to watch what Mick West just did with Tim Phillips. And then when I did, I started crying. It was just like too much. But yeah, it was good. It was good. It's a good feeling now.
Yeah.
Very good.
Well, and that's just it. You know, when you, that's kind of how I feel about everything with Epstein right now.
Yeah.
You know, because that is like human trafficking is one of the causes of this show. And we have been following that story doggedly since the days of Dudes and Beer.
Yeah.
You know,
and I remember back then I couldn't even tell you because I was in part of the investigation, and I couldn't talk about it because I was really in it, and I ended up with, you know, the unredacted version of the Little Black Book and all kinds of different stuff way back before, you know, anyone else even thought about having it. And I don't remember if I sent you a copy of it or not.
I've got the Little Black Book on the, just so you know, folks, feel free to go to the Knowledge Vault, go to hacked in court documents. You will find Epstein's Little Black Book right there.
There you go.
Unredacted.
You got the unredacted version. There you go.
Unredacted. The only way to fly.
So, exactly. So all of these things, when they were coming out, it just, you know, when you're actively involved in about four or five different high profile, you know, investigations, and people bring, like in my case, people will bring me in for some weird situational thing because I've proven in the past that I'm not going to reveal the secret. I'm not going to do this unless told to do so. Or blah, blah, blah. I'm very loyal in that regard, loyal to the point where I'll run my own career in the ground before I would do any of that. But there's a certain point where you have to turn the tables a little bit. Something has to go my direction. You know, I've done all this stuff for other people, and eventually you hope it turns around. And, you know, when it does, it, hopefully it'll be a good thing for everybody. Because I mean, that's the thing is to be able to get something right, in the beginning, and then, you know, however many years it takes before it becomes verified, and it come out, then it does make you feel good. It really does.
Absolutely. But, absolutely. Especially when you have doggedly held the same point. Like I have yeah. held on this show the whole time that I have believed it to be some sort of training exercise of other technology.
Yep.
When it came to the Nimitz. Yep. And that does not, once again, as I say on the show all the time, as we say at Curious Research, just because data proves something else from your video, your audio, your pictures, it does not remove your experience. It does not remove the way in which your keyhole was pried open with a crowbar. At that moment, when you questioned reality and opened your mind and opened the box, you know, it doesn't remove that moment. So,
And no one can take someone's experience away from them.
Right.
I mean, that's never the intent of anything.
Yeah.
It, in some ways, it's to explain how it happened. Like if I see something, my first thought is, like if a UFO landed right in front of me, I'm not a person that's going to back away from it. I'm going to walk up to it. If it zaps me and I die and I'm gone, then I'll be happy to be the first person to be officially verified that that happened to. You know?
Yeah.
But that's the kind of person I am. I always go towards things as opposed to away from things, and it gets me in trouble a lot.
Yeah.
But at the same time, it gets me the answers I'm looking for, and hopefully the answers someone else is looking for. And that's how me and Kevin Day, came about, because he wanted to know what it is, even if it was something prosaic. I mean, he knows what he saw the radar, and there was those key moments that when he told me something, like the objects were, you know, tracking from 80,000 feet down to 28,000 feet in a very short period of time, and down to the surface of the water in 0.78 seconds, and so forth. And then when I asked him that one question, because he said they were in formation coming down from Catalina Island and San Clemente. Yep. That area. And then I asked him the question, because it was the only thing that was blocking me, was that how could these objects be in a formation? And when he said that they were over 10, I asked him, I said, how far apart were these objects? And when he said they were over 10 miles apart, because if you ask anybody what an aircraft formation would look like, you're immediately thinking of like an air show or, you know, anything you had experience with, the planes would be close together. And when he said over 10 miles apart, then that immediately answered a lot of questions for me. And then I went down that path, and because Kevin Day, he has the most important part of the whole thing, because we would not even be talking if it wasn't for him going after these objects that he saw on his radar, because that was the very first part of the event. That's when all this started. As such, finding out what he was seeing was key. And then come to find out what Fravor saw, and then what Chad Underwood filmed, three different objects, three different events, three different times of the day.
Yeah.
A lot of people don't realize that this didn't happen all inside of 30 minutes. This was over a period of hours and hours. But now that the cat's about to be out of the bag, I'm going to be very cautious about how it's perceived. Try to, you know, put all the data with it and see where it goes. And then we still have the same thing where something was being tested. It was verified that it was being tested. DARPA verified that to Arrow. And Tim Phillips, who was the former head of Arrow, came out and actually said what it was. And I just sat there with my jaw on the floor going, okay, well, this is something I've been waiting on for 6 years and it just happened. What do I do now? Now just finalize essentially what amounts to be a report that's 7 years in the making and put it out there, and then let people have it and have a better understanding of what happened back then.
And not to have you speak, I mean, I'd love to have Kevin Day on to discuss this. I've wanted him on for years, and we've tried to make that happen. But what does he feel about this? What do they feel about this revelation what they experienced kind of an internal war game, so to speak.
Fravor didn't believe that anyone came on board the ship and took the data. I was adamant that that did occur, and I couldn't, at no time could I actually tell, told Kevin, that I have the information necessary to prove that that data was taken by DARPA. I just can't release it. now that it's basically out there and Tim Phillips said it in the open, I'm going to release it. I'm going to mention the briefing that was done at Wright-Patterson that I briefly mentioned way back when. It was verified by Chris Lambright, who did a FOIA request and verified that there was, in fact, a briefing that was done at Wright-Patt that was done, I think it was March or April of the following year, that had all this. But what we didn't know was what the contents of the briefing necessarily were, because my friend was an AV specialist, and he's the one that set up the slides for the briefing. And he had a conversation with me, which was outside of a SCIF. It was not anything that he should have done. It's a career-ending thing that he did. But it did happen. It does happen more often than people think. And I was never going to throw him under the bus. He's out now, so it's not a real way to affect him unless they wanted to take away his retirement. But I don't think that's even going to be the case now, because it'll fall under the whistleblower program. So I'm trying to pull him into the whistleblower program so he can tell the story in front of Congress, and I'll tell my story in front of Congress, and we'll go from there. You know, because the truth sometimes is stranger than fiction. And in this case, I think a lot of fiction has been told, you know, by the current characters that have been testimony, you know, their testimony has been heard in Congress. I think it's time for Congress to hear, you know, the actual truth, the factual truth. Some of it's boring, but some of it is pretty fantastical. So we'll, and everywhere in between, we'll see how it comes out. But, it's going to be this year is going to be an interesting year. It's going to be a very interesting year, because there's a lot of things, a lot of wheels are in motion.
I was going to say, yes, a lot of wheels in motion, a lot of people. Go ahead, Mike.
Yeah, a lot of people that were at the top of the game a while back that were surreptitiously doing things that people don't know about behind the scenes, and I don't want to bring that negative stuff back up, but there were people that were specifically targeting people like myself, trying to squelch us to not allow us to speak, because they knew, you know, it was obvious to them that we were touching on a subject matter that they knew was true, that would take away their cash cow, so to speak. And that's been proven to be the case. And now I think a lot of people saw the writing on the wall, especially if you're on Twitter or X, you can see the full history of it as it played out, because it's pretty much the battlefield where it's played on. But, you know, here it is. You know, I'm still here. I still got the same story. And we're going to push forward. And you're my trooper there, because every time you needed somebody to be on a show, I was there. And every time I needed to put a piece of information out, you were there. And it's worked out quite well. And I appreciate you for that. That's a friendship that cannot be measured.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
You're a good guy.
Here.
One of the good guys.
I firmly concur with you, my friend. You are the same to me, and it begs to ask the question, especially when, because once again, we would not be having this talk without Lou Elizondo. We wouldn't be having this. And I have asked since the beginning, how does a gentleman who worked in the halls of Alphabet agencies, the back halls, release two videos that were for internal release, cleared for internal release, not cleared for media release. So interdepartmental declassified, not media declassified. How does he go on to CNN and maintain not only his clearances and credentials, but land a government contract?
Exactly.
And, you know, you have to wonder that. And then to see that same person who, once again, years in the back halls of Alphabet agencies, not once, but twice, within less than a half a year while giving presentations, show images from his, quote, vetted sources that are utterly debunked, like within moments of them hitting the internet, like John Greenwald from Black Vault. Slapped down the chandelier picture within 5 minutes of it hitting social media. He did a back search on it and found that it was a picture of something else. And both of these are things that, so you do have to wonder about the disinformation machine. There have been many people that have questioned Arrow to begin with, like I've said the whole time.
Yeah.
Like it, hate it. The one thing I like is that now there's at least a unified reporting system and a way for people to come forward without losing their career, their wings, what have you. You know,
I've got to admit, after listening to Tim Phillips, I started to have a lot more respect for him and what he brought to the table and did, as opposed to say the UAP task force and things of that nature. And you know, you look where it's kind of like a look where they are now kind of thing. Like the Jay Stratton, Travis Taylor, and you say, okay, what did these guys bring to the table? And then after they brought the stuff to the table, where did they go afterwards? Okay, they went to Skinwalker Ranch. Okay, all right, that starts bringing in some other questions. But at the same time, you know, I work for Discovery. They work for the History Channel, and there's a battle between the two. I'm not allowed to go on pretty much the History Channel, and they're pretty much not allowed to come over to Discovery that much, unless it's, you know, national, international news or something. But, you know, you start looking at the players in this, and you say, okay, what would motivate someone? First off, was Lou Elizondo given that information knowing that, and the person knew that it was bogus to begin with? And then the problem is that Lou added on top of it the fact that he had talked to the pilots. What pilots? The pilots that were flying around the chandelier? What pilots are you talking about? And so he had the chandelier fiasco, then he had the crop circle, you know, fiasco thing. And then really the one that broke a lot of backs is the last one that he did with the Harlequin baby or whatever, and saying it's an alien and stuff. And that one really, for a lot of people, especially females that saw this, and it was terrible. So that's three strikes, you're out, essentially, in my book. But he's, you know, for someone to still maintain a security clearance after all of these incidences, there's something else that has to be there. He has to have leverage or on something. And I don't want to speculate that too much, but there has to be something there. I don't know what it is.
Hey, and speaking of something there, you know, the one thing that I've said, even when it comes to remote viewing, things like that, when people are like, well, you know, there wasn't a whole lot that was really gathered through that program. It's why they canceled it. It's like, well, number one, they were funded for like 20 something years.
Yeah.
You know, so they normally don't fund a program when they ain't getting nothing out of it, and they don't continue funding it, much less do they. And now, granted, what happened was they took that human intelligence that's being gathered. And yeah, they took it out of government hands and they put it into the hands of contractors where it can be used and used and used, and nobody asks a question. You know, it's already within the dark money of a Blackwater or somebody like that. But when you're looking at even
the individual,
go ahead.
The individual behind all that, which you and I both know his name, and I'll mention it here in a second. But I sent a analysis of the GoFest video when GoFest came out.
Yeah.
Keep in mind, GoFest didn't come out at the same time the other two videos came out. It came out like March of the following year.
Yep.
I don't remember the date, but it was sometime in March, and I looked at it and I'm like, wow, all the information I need to figure out how fast this object is and what its altitude is inside the video, because I became very familiar with that flare. I had a friend that was a lead project engineer. His name was, well, I call him AZ. His name is Andy, and he, became very an important part. He wouldn't reveal anything that was like top secret to me or whatever, but some of the information that I'd have, he would start to explain it in ways that I could re-explain it to where it makes sense. And one of the key pieces of information allowed me to determine the altitude, the speed, the direction, all the stuff of that object. And when it came out to be 38 miles an hour and at 13,000 feet, it was nothing even close to what TTSA was saying.
Yeah.
Mick West and Metabunk crew, they had figured it out. We all figured it out about the same time.
Yeah.
Because it wasn't rocket science by any means. But what was so weird was, how in the world did this video, it was delayed being brought out several months to begin with. And then when it did come out, that they didn't already figure out the speed and the altitude using the experts that they have in the military. that were familiar with the systems that had, you know, top secret clearances and all this.
Yeah.
They couldn't figure it out. So I took that video and I made an analysis and I sent it to Tom DeLong. I said, listen, I worded it properly, but in a nutshell, I basically said, here's the video. Here's the problem with the video. And it shows the actual altitude of the object and what the object's doing and the speed of the object. You guys are going to be very embarrassed if you go any further with this. Never received a response back. But that file name that I sent to him ended up being on the desktop of a certain individual who was doing a webinar. And in the bottom right-hand corner of his, I don't know if you remember this or not, but and I'll send you the picture. In the bottom right-hand corner of his computer was that analysis of GoFast. It was my analysis. It says right on it, Mike Turber, GoFast analysis. Well, and I'm thinking, well, I made it to the person that started all of this, and that was obviously Hal Putoff.
The GoFast video was eviscerated in the same way by the NASA panel.
Yeah.
With the fact of all the data, all the data we need is right here in the heads up display of the craft recording this video. In the last 10 minutes here, one of the things that I want to bring up is once again, that historic use of things, because of course, even ATIP was one of those, when they switched things from UFO to UAP, sneaky, very sneaky peep maneuver, but yes, that does legally allow them to say, like, sorry for your request, we don't look into UFOs. And say what you want about Arrow, anything like that, but the first document that they read, the document that they released, right here, we have it up, the report on historic record of U.S. government involvement with unidentified anomalous phenomena, volume one, mind you. Now, it goes from the first one, Project Saucer in 1946-47, Project Sign 1948-49, Project Grudge, original organization 1949, Project Twinkle 1949-1950, Grudge reestablishment 1951-1952, Project Bear 1951-1954, that's CIA Special Study Program 1952, Robertson Panel 1953, Durant Report 1953, Project Blue Book 52-69, CIA evaluation of UFOs 64, O'Brien Committee 64, Condon Report 68, National Academy of Assessments of Condon Report 68. This goes all the way through to 2000, Roswell Investigations and Inquiries 1992-2001. This interest goes and it shows an unbroken pattern. At no point from the founding of the U.S. Air Corps in the way that we know it, which became the U.S. Right. Air Force, everything from World War II on is an unbroken chain of programs looking into UFOs, UAPs. An unbroken chain. Relabeled, rebranded, shifted over here to this Alpha Beta agency, then brought back. But it's an unbroken chain of evidence that at least, at the very least, the government is more fascinated than the average American out there.
Yeah. Because there's two ways to look at it, too. So one of them is that the government was interested in how our own people would perceive seeing this technology, because you can't hide it forever. The planes and some of the equipment have to get out and practice.
Yeah.
And then, we have, you know, just like the F-117, that was probably the best kept airplane secret for the longest time, because for 20 years it was under wraps and no one knew essentially what it was. And then it came out the first time it was used was in Panama, but the Gulf War is when it was signed.
Yeah.
So the F-117 was one of the best kept secrets. Even SR-72 wasn't kept that long. It's pretty interesting how the government does the programs one way to see how we perceive it ourselves, and then how others perceive it, or if there is something else out there, which is the bigger question.
Absolutely, and you know, Man, we've had the conversation privately and on the show. Most likely there is something else out there. The problem is it would probably it'd probably lock the door as it passed by.
It probably came here and didn't find any intelligent life and took off.
Their craft would come by and it'd be like the car in National Lampoon's in a heartbeat. Just like we'd have it stripped for parts so fast.
We'd have to hire like 50 Bob Lazars.
That's it. And I can't wait till his movie comes out. It's great. And don't get me wrong, folks. We are having a little bit of fun here at the end. But in all reality, this is just the fact of, once again, there is confirmation that, yes, the government has used the stories that are put out in media and stuff like that as cover for years and years. Most definitely.
Yeah.
And without a doubt, what we have seen with the world of Tic Tac is man-made. Whether or not it's from recovered technology, who knows? Who knows right now? But what we know right now is that is fully possible to be man-made. So, Mike Turber, as always, thank you so much for the time. Thank you, as always, for coming on, breaking these deep things down. Let everybody know where they can go to follow you, where they can go to keep track of things, where they can go to keep up with all that is 5x5 News, especially all of the upcoming releases about all of this.
Yeah, probably the easiest that's going to be the most up-to-date will be on X. That seems to be the platform that where someone's going to release something, it's pretty much going to be there. So pretty much there, YouTube will be part of it. TikTok, I'm going to revamp it up a little bit and get it up to speed so I can do lives there. They seem to be a little bit more conducive to doing lives. I'll do a space on X here, but the problem with doing spaces is you don't have the visual component. So it's not as conducive to relay visual information in a verbal way, which is kind of what I'm doing today anyway. But overall, those would be the places to find out. And if anyone ever needs to get a hold of me, any questions or anything like that, it's just my name, which is MikeTurber@gmail.com. Just ask me directly and I can try to help you out.
Absolutely. Mike, thank you as always for your time, bud. It's always great catching up.
Thank you, brother.
Hold the line real quick while we close things out with the audience while you are online. And don't forget, folks, follow Mike on YouTube as well. 5x5 News US is his channel at 5x5 News US right there on YouTube, folks. And while you are online checking out Mike's YouTube, make sure to stop on by Curious Realm. CuriousRealm.com is where you can go to our videos page and follow all of the channels of our guests. That's where you can go to the store and buy the books, classes, and movies by our guests. That's also where you can find your link to Curious Research and our field observation and encounter log. If you are a field researcher in the world of UFOs, UAPs, stop on by, get your copy of that. Thank you so much. When we come back from this quick commercial break, everybody, we will be joined by our friend Anne Celine. We will be talking about paranormal encounters. What are they? What are they about? How do we react to them psychologically? How do they impact us for the rest of our life? We'll be talking about that and more right after this.
You can easily keep track of your investigative information all in one place, making it easier to review cases and readily see comparisons and contrasts between them. Whether out in the woods squatching, in a back room gathering EVPs, or using high-tech gear to track UFO UAP activity, this easy-to-carry, pocket-sized scientific data log is the perfect companion for any field researcher. You can find your copy of the Curious Research Field Observation and Encounter Log at Amazon.com. Or visit the official Curious Realm store at CuriousRealm.com/store to reserve your copy for yourself, your family, or a mind that you want to open. That website again is CuriousRealm.com/store.
everybody, and welcome back from that quick commercial break. Thank you so much to Mike Turber for his wealth of knowledge in breaking down what may well be our technology in the skies. We have talked with him about this since the day that the Tic Tac videos launched. So look into that stuff, folks. Look into those patents there on our knowledge vault. And also, look into True Hemp Science. TrueHempScience.com is your source for amazing CBD products. If you're a user of CBD like I am, stop on by and check them out. Christopher Lynch and True Hemp Science use a spigeric process using every part of the hemp plant: roots, seeds, stems, buds, leaves. Every part of the plant is used, combusted, reused, and that process followed again and again until nothing remains, providing an amazing spigeric product complete with terpene profiles and all. Stop on by, check them out. TrueHempScience.com is the website that you want to go to. Curious7 is the code that you want to use to save 7% off your entire cart of $50 or more. Our guest in this segment is the amazing Ann Selene. She is a researcher. She is an author. We will be talking with her about personal paranormal, the idea of how do we take our personal experiences and move forward in life. Welcome back to the show. Ann Selene, how are you today?
Hi, thank you so much for having me back. I'm wonderful. I'm excited to be here.
It's always great talking with you. We chat all the time on social media and in the background, things like that. And it's been really interesting to see some of the things that have popped up recently in the world of paranormal. And when it comes to paranormal, it's one of those, it's different for everybody. Like, I was just at the Psy Games this last week, and one of the things I talked about was we need to start unpacking paranormal. We have been shoving things into the trash can called paranormal for decades. Right. And when it starts to overflow, we take a big old stick and we shove it down more to make some extra room to shove in more topics that we just call paranormal, you know.
Correct.
And the thing is, as that happens, it really does kick up and muddy the waters. It doesn't help filter anything. It doesn't help us filter definitions between experiences, and it doesn't definitely help us help the experiencer by doing that.
Right.
So,
no, that's true.
Yeah. How do you see paranormal to begin with, Ann Selene? Like, what is your definition? Of course, something other than normal. But where do you draw the line in the difference between, let's say, like paranormal, cryptozoology, things like that? At what point are they in defined categories for you?
You know, it's hard because it's, In the very beginning, paranormal and supernatural all to me meant ghosts and shadow entities and aliens, UFOs, and the Loch Ness Monster. So everything was under this umbrella category. Yeah. And so then I get deeper into it and I begin to look at the word preternatural. So things that are, you know, they're a part of our world, just not really, you know, how do I want to phrase that? It's when you look at ghosts and aliens, you see that as something outside of our world that is, you know, not natural and it's not a part of it. But at the same time, when you look at things like witchcraft and witches, you know, they were wise women. They were using parts of our natural world to do these things. And I know I'm kind of jumping all over the place here.
No, that's okay. That's okay.
But so I think that spirits and ghosts and shadow entities are very much a natural part of our world. I don't think it's a paranormal, scary, supernatural thing. And then to go even deeper, though, how much are these outside of us versus within us being projected? So, you know, now when we look at cryptids, you know, to me, a lot of these things like Sasquatch could be zoologically possible. And so, therefore, it's just a critter that hasn't been discovered yet, or, you know, is now, we're trying to see if it went extinct and then came back or whatever. But then you have things that are like the Jersey Devil or the Mothman, you know, things that aren't necessarily zoologically possible. And so that you could put into a, you know, the paranormal, I guess, category.
Yeah.
Not so much a cryptid, I wouldn't think. So it's very, I mean, it's very difficult to define it. But if we can look at it in this way and break it up into different categories, especially looking at the human mind and everything that it's capable of, to be able to separate what we can create ourselves and what is true paranormal,
yeah,
then we're going to be able to do a lot more for experiencers and the field as a whole.
Yeah. Yeah, precisely. And you know, you bring up a really good point, and that is understanding ourselves as humans, understanding the way that we think, the patterns in which we think, the way in which our brain wants to see patterns, strives to see patterns, you know. Eva, and I hate bringing up the nasty P word, but pareidolia.
Yes.
It even comes into effect, you know, and the fact of are you seeing something, or are you seeing something that is being impressed upon you? Or are you seeing something that your mind is building as an impression of something that you see and are familiar with?
That's the hard thing.
Yeah.
Because the mind is all about putting the puzzle pieces together. It's desperate to fill in the gaps.
It is.
So, you know, let's say you have a, I'll get personal, I guess. So, I had an experience when I was a child that I believed was perhaps a alien encounter, if you will, an experience in my bedroom when I was around 6 or 7 years old. And in my mind, I thought that there was this being in my room, and I thought that it was, you know, trying to kind of hide as it was going around, you know, the base of my bed. And then I felt it touch me on my lower back on my right side. Well, years later, I came across a book that said, I think it's Abduction, How People Come to Believe They Were Abducted by Aliens. And it goes into trauma, somatic anxiety, somatic trauma, so where trauma is stored within the body, and how these things can follow us throughout our life. So I always had problems with that part of my back. Well, then I found out what actually happened at that age. Mm. And it was a real world traumatic situation. And so it was hard to grapple with at first. And I wasn't sure if I ever wanted to come out and talk about it. But
yeah.
I find it important because this goes to show that I already had a predisposition to believe in aliens and all that kind of stuff because of the stuff I loved to watch with my father.
Sure.
And so, of course, at that young age, my mind would fill in the gap and sit there and say, all right, you had an alien abduction. Because as scary as it would be to have this experience with an alien or whatever, it was better. It was easier to handle than to know that somebody I knew
violated your privacy something. In such a way.
Right, exactly. So, and that's outside of you, you know, thinking of aliens, that you're really, your mind is really separating it. But when you find out that it's a person, it's much, you know, closer, and it's a lot harder to deal with. And so as an act of survival, my brain constructed that, false memory. It was not, you know, but that can be a really hard thing for people to grapple with. They're not going to want to really face themselves sometimes, because then they might sit there and think, what part did I play in it? Was it my fault? They have to work through that. And then they have to look at the human that they encountered doing this, you know, and then they have to reconcile that and figure that relationship out. And that is so much harder than, you know, going into, I got to ride on a shiny spaceship and do this, you know?
And, you know, that brings up a couple of really important points that you and I discuss regularly off air and that I discuss on the show regularly. And that's, that's the idea that dissociation works two ways.
Yes.
You know, so yes, your mind gave you an associative memory that you could accept so that you could dissociate from the pain that you experienced. However, your mind can also dissociate, from an experience that it cannot understand and that it cannot get. That as our good friend who is now passed, Earl Grey, and Earl, should you have any great wisdom from the other side, feel free to impart it, my friend, anytime. But the idea that there is an ontologic shock that happens, there is a point that happens where when you have experienced something paranormal, you go into the same exact space that your mind went into to protect you from that horrible experience. It's got to make sense of it somehow. It's got to, as I popped up from that article from Psychology Today, it's got to fill in the blanks of that pattern somehow with anything that it can grasp onto, any straw that it can grasp onto of reality. You know, so even if that is an experience that you have heard about, if it is something that you have read about, it, if it's something that makes sense to you, then that is normally what your mind will go with. And, you know, once again, people, this does not, as we say on the show all the time, just because you have a red circle on a picture or a video and a professional says, hey, I can explain to you how that image in the red circle was made and what that is, that does not remove your experience of taking the picture. Just because your mind has done this does not remove the actual experience that has happened to you, or even the experience of your mind doing this and you realizing that there is something larger out there that has changed you. It doesn't remove that experience. It doesn't take that away and change who you intrinsically are just because that moment is explained.
Exactly. It does. And, you know, and this isn't the blanket statement, you know, or the you know, for people's experiences. No. I believe, you know, I definitely believe in the paranormal. I definitely believe in several of my experiences. But I'm my best guinea pig, right? So I've gone to therapy. I've read a bunch of psychology books to try and really decipher, okay, what was trauma? Because I have that. I've got PTSD from things that have happened.
Sure.
So what was trauma? And what is genuine? And I think that it's extremely important, not just for me, but for the field and everybody that, you know, when we're at these conferences and stuff, when they come to us and they talk to us, because this is, to me, this is where the real healing takes place. And then if we can also decipher between what is occurring natural and human, you know, versus what's paranormal, then I think we get closer to the truth.
Yeah.
So, I mean, so here again, so to piggyback off of what you were saying in regards to our minds, you know, putting things together with, you know, I had made a post not long ago asking about night myopia.
Yep.
This was in regards to people seeing things like a Sasquatch at night. You know, you're in the woods and you see this shadowy shape. But this doesn't just go for Sasquatch. This is also goes for like shadow entities or like,
absolutely.
I remember being investigating at night I think it was Fairfield in Ohio. And I couldn't tell if I saw the shape of a person kind of popping in and out of a door. And, I recognize that I have my own fears, my own set of pre-loaded fears. And so my brain, because it's hard to see, and I do have night blindness, it's terrible. My eyes just, I can't see anything at night. So blobs and shapes, my brain will put them into things that I can recognize to try to make sense of what I'm seeing, to try to either be like, oh, this is why you're afraid, this is why you need to run, or oh, it's just
Yeah.
this, so be comforted. To me, it would be harder to take reports of nighttime shadows. It'd
Sure.
be interesting to look into those and look into the medical of the person with their eyes and also what else happened during that night to support this shadow figure. Was there anything else, or was that it?
Yeah. Well, and it, like I've had shadow person experiences, things like that. I've had something slap my feet, which I assumed was our old cat. It was shortly after he passed, things like that. But and it's one of those, hey, if any one of those experiences should ever be explained, okay, it once again doesn't remove my experience, my observation, and my question, first two steps of science. So if you've seen something or experienced something and you had a question, like science began, and that's with paranormal as well. So yeah, the idea that we contribute a lot. We are a huge contributing factor to our experience. And even the fact, Dan, that once again, you have had numerous experiences in your life. You have researched these things. You have looked into these things. But quite literally, in the last year, the conversations we had before and the conversations we have now are vastly different because of your understanding. Not only like you've explored a lot of things in the last year and a lot of things connecting paranormal to this stuff. Because that is where your experience of helping yourself went. And it's been very interesting to see how you have processed your experiences in this kind of way,
Oh, thank you.
and been very open to doing so. Because one of the most important things in any research is A, realizing your research, it cannot occur in a vacuum. It cannot occur in a vacuum. That's not how proper research is done. You've got to have
Correct.
somebody that you can bang things off of, talk with. And you also have to be willing to kill your darlings, which means
Yes.
if you've come up with a hypothesis or an explanation of what something is, you may later be led to other evidence, other studies, other topics, all kinds of things that may pull that hypothesis away or pull the support of that away. Your research partner may be like, well, I don't know if you've looked at this. And you have to be willing to go, oh my, you're right. I didn't look at that. So the fact that you had very, very well-formed opinions about your experiences and what had happened, and your studies in other topics have brought you to another understanding of what those experiences were. Like, once again, there's a reason why this part of the episode is called Personal Paranormal. Because it's one of those, we have to be willing to examine ourselves. And if we aren't willing to examine ourselves and our place, and even our place in the journey of, where we are in the investigation of not only what has happened to us as experiencers, but what is happening in the field, what is of whichever paradiscipline you study. And I asked you at the beginning of the show to define paranormal. I will do it myself. A, yes, anything that is outside of the paranormal. However, I tend to get much like science, is categorized as possible. You know, I will always say experiencers of UFO UAP tend to experience other paranormal things. Same things with cryptids, same things with, parapsychological events, you know, stuff like that. So, and I kept bringing it up this weekend, you know, because there were a couple people that kept saying, this is the best paranormal conference ever. And I was like, well, it's really a parapsychological conference.
Right.
There is nothing paranormal going on here. There's no EVPs.
Right.
There's no, you know, I tend to put paranormal mostly in the realm of ghosts.
Right.
That is what I specifically put paranormal to. Everything that we talk about is paranormal, technically, because it's outside of the norms of society and conversation.
Right.
It's much like saying, did I see a UFO? Yes, I've technically seen a UFO. It was a thing going through the sky that was amorphous. It was flying. It was an object. I don't know what it was. But would I say that I've seen a craft? No. No.
Right.
Because that to me is a definable object. You know,
right.
So keeping those definitions clear as possible anyway, keeping those things separated in your mind is a great way to start, literally, to begin giving things it's not about confusing things or trying to keep you from thinking about things. It's more about letting you think outside of the box,
right?
Within a paradigm, you know,
right?
Because otherwise, you can think way too outside of the box and get completely lost. You know, you still kind of have to focus that outside of the box thinking.
Like, that's true.
Even in a brainstorming session with an engineering group, you can't just fully free think. You know, you got to stay somewhat on task and on target with the outside of the box thinking that you're doing. You know, so you've got to keep in reins.
It's you know, because in the beginning, as a child, you know, all that stuff was paranormal and it was spooky. It was the campfire stories. It was the, are you afraid of the dark and Goosebumps, you know?
Yeah.
And so this is where all of my interest grew. And then from there, I ended up reading, I got into folklore and there were some websites that had great stories on it. You know, I wish I could remember the name of it, but like there's the Devil's Tramping Ground, there's the Mako Lights, and everything was just spooky. And, you know, then I had all my different experiences. Some I was alone, some I was with others. And, you know, I have everything chronological in my book. And so then I end up having my own podcast and I start interviewing other people and, you know, I'm getting into quantum physics and quantum mechanics. And then I'm even more so in the podcast world. And, you know, I ended up having, you know, KPNL radio for a time from 2020 until I think 2024. And, so I got deeper and deeper into the research. And the more you learn, of course, the more you figure out that you don't know and you're never going to know. And it's just this constant evolving thing. And so then I, you know, jump into psychology. And I decided, you know, the best thing I could do is research myself in regards to my singular experiences that I had on my own and really put it underneath the microscope. And I even took it to therapy to be like, all right, let's explore all these different, you know, options. And, you know, the ones that I experienced with other people, witnesses and stuff, they, you know, they're in their own category and I'll go through that stuff later, but I'm still in the process of, you know, putting myself under the microscope. Now, my book is going to be republished. However, I'm not changing it. I mean, the title and the cover is changing because I think that originally it was too ambiguous and it was hard to understand.
Yeah.
And then, so it's going to be more clear. And then I'm writing a second book, which there's a little, like, preview of that in the back of the book. However, the meat and potatoes of it is not changing, because I want people to see where I was in my first book and then where I am now in my second book, and how that transition can take place. Because I don't know how many people really consider that just because you have that belief doesn't mean it always has to stay, and it doesn't mean that you were necessarily wrong. You were just in that space at that time, and we all evolve in many different ways.
Well, and the thing is, we have to be willing to evolve. People have asked me before, because of course I did all the branding for the show, things like that. And yes, we talk a little bit about conspiracy on this show. There's a reason why the logo incorporates an unfinished pyramid.
Right.
But it also has the magnifying glass there in place, because our job is to demystify that conspiracy theory and actually examine it and look at it, you know. So, but it's also there because esoterically we are unfinished pyramids. That's the message of that symbol, is that the temple is never finished. You know, you are always under construction. You're always growing. You're always changing.
Eternal student.
Well, and you should always be, much like I tell people all the time, I wear the badge of skeptic with honor. I do not consider it a nasty word, not if done properly. I am not here to troll anybody. I'm not here to, I am here to explain things. I'm here to demystify. I am a believer. I have had my experiences, but because of that, my realm of evidence must be higher. What I call evidence must be higher. And like I say on the show all the time, like I say in my presentations, evidence is a word used to keep you out of court, or to keep you out of prison, or to put you in it. Never let it be less than that. You know, there's a lot of things that pieces of data in a court case go through to become evidence. And there's such a thing as evidence that is slam dunk, and such a thing as evidence that is like very, very cursory, like people's just word about something. And don't get me wrong, I believe the experiencer until proven otherwise. But we have to be willing to admit that. We have to be willing to say that. Like you have to be, had to be willing to examine your experiences through a different lens once you found that lens that, that looked at things in that kind of way. You've got to be willing to.
Well, you know, and as somebody who really is committed to healing, right? So I believe that healing myself, I mean, and this is like the number one thing, everybody is, it's our jobs to look within ourselves and heal ourselves, because in doing that, we essentially can really heal and affect the world. Because the way that, you know, it's like when somebody comes to me and says, oh my gosh, this person treated me X, Y, Z, you know, or they said this, or they said that, or behaved whatever. Well, that's a reflection of them. And it has nothing to do with us. And it has to do with their personal relationship with themselves on the inside. And this is why we have to do that work. Because then if we do that work, we're projecting a lot more positively on the world around us and on everybody that we end up encountering. So if I can take that, if I can take the hot seat, put myself under the microscope, and really try to heal myself, then I also understand what that feels like. I can understand what somebody would go through. And then I can kind of shine that light for others and let them know that they're not alone, and let them know that there is no shame in being like, oh, I totally called myself a an abductee for XYZ years or whatever it was. And then to be like, no, I'm a, what would it be called? A trauma, the trauma experiencer or whatever, instead of an abductee or whatever. And there's no shame in either one.
That's right.
You know, but so I'm willing to go through that for others. I'm willing to do this so that way, we can have more healing and love in our field, and in the world.
Yeah, no, exactly. Because we, A, And I love seeing people share stories at shows that I go to.
Yeah.
I love it. The people who are open-hearted about it. It is beautiful to see that, because somewhere, mm-hmm. probably just within earshot, is an experiencer that doesn't want to share their story or is reticent to share their story and doesn't feel comfortable sharing their story. So every exactly. time they hear somebody share their story in that mm-hmm. kind of way, it gets them one step closer to at least revealing their truth, or mm-hmm. at least coming to terms with their truth. Because once again, their story may incorporate all kinds of things that have been brought together as mm-hmm. a woven cord within their mind.
Oh, yeah.
You know.
Exactly.
So we have to be willing to look at that. We have to be willing to explore that. And like you said, we have to be willing to see that within ourselves. And yeah. it's been really great, once again, to see you over the last year or so really move into that space. Because it's one of those, even the work of Kathleen Martin mm-hmm. took the turn toward the spiritual eventually.
Right.
And she right. has been, she is an experiencer. She's the niece of Betty and Barney Hill. She has been
right.
One of the founding members of MUFON's experiencer resource team. She did a whole, and it was after she did her study on experiencers and started seeing people's healing qualities that they'd come back with, people who had come back yeah. and been healed, people who came back and were somehow magnetically attracting
right.
other experiences. Right. And that's when her work took the turn of the spiritual path of the experiencer after their experience and how it changes
yeah.
them and how it opens up different realms of spiritual knowledge and different ways that you look and process the world, you know?
Oh, yeah. It's one of those things where whenever we have an experience, no matter what it is, no matter what the actual truth is, when we experience it, whatever domino effect has after that, we were supposed to experience it in that exact way, processing it in the belief that we did at the time, because it changes our path and it can, you know, it can take us down a different path, or it can help us learn something or whatever it is. So it's extremely important that, you know, at the time, for the, you know, like for me, thinking that it was all this alien type of a thing.
Yeah.
I don't think that I would have understood, psychologically speaking, how the brain could do that. Unless I personally was an experience, you know, an experiencer of that particular your situation, you know. I mean, I remember early on somebody asked me when I was doing a podcast, this is like way back. They said, "You've had so many experiences, would you trade it?" Mm. And I remember telling them, no, I wouldn't, because, you know, it's enabled me to tell my stories. And then other people have said, oh, I've had that experience too.
Yeah.
And so if I was to be asked it again, knowing that some of the, what I thought was paranormal was actually, you know, very traumatic human-wise, I don't know how to phrase it. Would I trade that? Still no, because now I have this much more in-depth knowledge of what can take place, and this is a deeper healing than I thought was possible. And so if I can gift that to others, you know, then great.
Yeah. Yeah. No, precisely. And it's one of those, if you can help anybody with the experiences that you've had in life, with that
yeah.
open heart, that open mind, it's hugely important to do so. And especially being able to explain to them that, A, they're not alone. They don't have to experience it alone. They don't have to go through it alone. Mm-hmm. I venture a guess that 75% of people have had some mm-hmm. sort of experience of the paranormal in their life. Something
yes.
that just flabbergasted them, or that they could not explain, that
right.
that they either chose to ignore, or were told like, oh, don't worry about that by their family or, you know, what have you. But I would venture a guess that most of us have had that kind of experience at some point. The only question is whether or not we give it credence or talk about it.
Right.
You know?
Exactly.
So with that in mind, how do we begin to, I guess, bring people to the point of being okay? Being okay with having experienced something, being okay with, because these experiences, one of the examples I give is Terry Lovelace. Terry, if you're out there, if you're listening, call me, brother. It's been a long time. but when he had his experience in Devil's Den, he was with a friend of his that he rode in as an EMT with, you know, and the example I give with that is that when you ride as an EMT with somebody, you see things, you know, that it's no different than riding. Like if your EMT partner has a kid, like you're going to that kid's wedding, you know, you are intimately involved in that person's life. Because of the things that you have seen together, done together, been through together, much less if it was military, which it was. So their experience, his experience, he says that his friend had an experience and would never, ever, ever talk about it. But this eventually led to them splitting. They don't talk. It was kind of the same thing like with Travis Walton and everything that happened with his friends. He's still very, very good friends with a lot of people that were there, but it drove a wedge in the community, his experience, you know, to the point that like his friends were accused of murder. Mike Heston, like lost national logging contracts, stuff like that, you know, with the National Forestry Service. So it was a long-term affect to everybody involved with that case, you know, and to be okay with that, to have interviewed him lately and to hear him say like, yeah, I wouldn't get in the thing now. but I'm okay with my experience. I've come to terms with what happened to me. I understand it in a different light. You know, I understand that if they'd wanted to kill me, if they had any kind of ill intent, that could have been fully realized. You know? How do we begin to go ahead?
It's so hard because I'm remembering there was a situation that I had a friend. This was back in 2019, 2020. And this has nothing to do with the paranormal.
That's okay.
We were talking and I had suggested that, you know, I said, you know, I suffer from anxiety. And I was diagnosed with having an anxiety disorder. And I said, you know, so sometimes I feel A, B, C or whatever it is. And I noticed that sometimes you seem like maybe you're feeling that as well. Maybe you're feeling really heavy in your chest and, you know, this situation may cause that or whatever. And I did it as gentle as possible that I thought that I could. And this person came unglued. They were very upset at me for suggesting that they could have something wrong with them that, you know, it was almost like they looked at it like their body was betraying them or that they were crazy.
Yeah.
Which is not the case. You just, your body, your brain, like for me, my body produces more cortisol than maybe yours, you know, or somebody else. Yeah. That's it. It's just a simple chemical. It's a brain reaction. It's the way that it functions. And I'm not less than, I'm not broken. I just function different and that's it. But there are a lot of old world beliefs in regards to that. It's kind of like when people teach, like, whether it's toxic masculinity or, you know, whatever, there's just all these schemas, right? These belief systems around certain things. So how do you unteach that? That's the question. You know, so to get anybody to be comfortable with themselves, I mean, this can be so hard. You hold up a yeah. mirror and somebody wants to run away or punch the thing because they can't. So I guess it would almost be cultivating self-love, which is way yeah. out there. It has nothing to do with, you know what I mean? So,
but it does. I wouldn't say it has nothing to do with it. Because it understanding yourself. I mean, you know, we were even talking about this with Keith Click. Keith Click, if you're out there listening, shout out to Ape Mindset. Check out his work, Anne. ApeMindset.com.
I will.
And it's one of those the idea that how we process information, how we bring information into our body, how we react mm-hmm. to that information and that stimuli in real time as it occurs, as an anxiety sufferer, as somebody who suffers panic attacks, stuff like that,
yeah.
it is hugely important that you be acutely aware
yes.
of your body and yes. of your somatic nervous system, the way in which, because I mean, when I went to my panic doctor, one of the things after about the third meeting, he's like, okay, mm-hmm. I have a few things to tell you. He's like, I understand your worries. I understand your concerns. And I hear you, you know, you come from a family of heart, like there's nobody on my dad's side. Nobody on my dad's side, who's a man, doesn't have a stent or a zipper scar, just about,
oh,
you know,
right.
So it's one of those, like when I'm not going to say I'm the most healthy dude in the world. Okay. I'm not like going to the gym. I'm not working right. out, things like that. But when I start sweating the way I do at work, sometimes when I start over exerting myself, it gets to a right. point where it was very scary to me for a yeah. long time, where it was bad. At least mm-hmm. in my mind. And the doctor was like, it's not. That is a normal human bodily reaction that you are having.
Mm-hmm.
And just so you know, no panic attack, no anxiety attack will ever cause you to have a heart attack. It cannot happen. It will not happen. That's not the way that works.
Wow.
He was like, what's happened? And he started backtracking me and making me understand like what these different reactions of my body were doing. And when you start feeling this, start thinking about this, like start changing the way you yeah. are intaking information, start backtracking what you care about so much that may have been rocked beyond your control.
Right.
You know,
right.
And understanding yourself to a point that you are literally willing to let that go and understand yeah. that the only thing you have control over right now is your mental reaction to what's happening. That's the only thing you have control right. of. The rest of it will pass. It will subside. Aversion therapy isn't going to help you. Leaving the situation isn't going to help you. You got to learn to get through the situation.
Right.
And yeah, as we talked about with Keith Click with Ape Mindset at the Psy Games this last week, it was the idea that if you don't know those things, if you don't understand what your body's connection is,
right.
you may not be able to do proper readings. You may not be able to do proper dowsing. You may not be able to get.
Oh, yeah.
You know, like one of the most important things about a good remote viewing session is the self-check before you start. You know,
right.
the idea that like you start a self-check process where it's like, okay, what things have been distracting me this week?
Mm-hmm.
What emotional things have happened to me this week that may interfere with the session? Like write them down on a piece of paper so that you're physically getting them out of your mind and out somewhere else. You know, things
yeah.
like that.
Yeah.
But if you aren't familiar with what those feelings in your body are, you may be missing out on massive, massive clues from the subconscious as far as what the hit on target is.
Knowing yourself in that way, let me tell you. So, there were times that I was so disconnected from myself, and I couldn't tell, like, silly things like, am I hungry or am I thirsty? Did I eat today? Like, just so disconnected, right? And then, I wanted to do more. I wanted to, I still really want to help people in the community and everything. And I love going to these conferences and stuff, but like I have social anxiety I've learned, okay, so I've got social anxiety. So what does that look like? And when are the symptoms? Like, what is my threshold? What is my, window of tolerance?
Sure.
And so, I'll even go to the grocery store on certain days that I know that there's not going to be as much movement, we'll be at a conference and I'll step outside for a little bit to just kind of reground myself because I get overwhelmed and there's so many people and I love them and I want to connect with them, but
Muddled energy though. And it's nothing against them. They're just excited and exuding energy. It's utterly on you as to how you're taking the energy in.
Exactly. And so it's my job to do that work. It's my job to go and regulate myself, take that breather, come back in. And, but here again, like I still don't think that I'm broken. I just function differently. It's no different than, you have paint, right? So you can do watercolors. You can do acrylic on a piece of paper, or you can do oil on canvas. And then there's all these different kinds of paint brushes, a fan brush or a little, whatever. And so you just have to learn what is your medium.
Yeah.
And then just function within that and just learn that every type of painting is beautiful.
Well, and that's a huge point to bring up in the last few minutes here, and is the fact that we've all had our experiences. We're all in a different place with them. But once again, like Earl Grey used to say, that experience was just for you.
Yes.
It was just for you. Ugh. It was unique and existed in that moment just for you. And we have to honor that. We have to honor that with other experiencers. And hey, whether or not you believe, here's something. And this is just a comment that goes beyond this show. It goes beyond the paranormal and ekes into everything in life. You can just scroll up. You don't have to comment.
Yep.
You don't have to say it. Like, you've consented. If anything comes from your comment, you have fully consented into that.
Yes.
You didn't have to comment.
Right.
When somebody tells you their experience, you don't have to say anything that will tear them down. You don't have to say anything that will cause them to doubt their experience. You don't have to do that, people. Because I guarantee you there are experiences in your life that could be called out just as easy. The differences are experiences are who we are. They are what make us. And now, granted, that means that also we don't have to let those experiences define us. And as an experiencer of trauma in life, you understand that this thing happened to you. Was it good? No. Was it good on behalf of the person that perpetrated it? No. But do you have to let that one moment in life that you were not in control of whatsoever define you as a person? No. No, you do not. You don't have to let that trauma define you. Even Travis Walton said that you don't have to let this be everything that you are.
Right. No, it's one piece of the puzzle. And if I may, because I can hear people saying, but I did have to comment and I did have to do this or that.
Sure, sure.
If you're one of those people that felt like, no, but I had
compelled to.
Yeah, compelled to. The best advice I can give is to figure out why. That's a perfect little thing that shows, like, okay, something within you is reaching out. Go within to figure it out instead of going and making a comment outside of yourself. Use that as a moment to travel within.
Yeah. Yeah. No, that is a beautiful point to bring up because, that is a great moment of self-exploration to find out why you are compelled to, especially compelled to comment in such a way. One of the things I taught when I taught CCE for years to junior high and high school students, and even whenever I taught adult CCE, it was the idea that I taught people was that everything you say and hear needs to be rewired through your heart. Everything. Before it comes out of your brain to your lips, let it go through your heart. Yeah. Just filter it through there real quick. Think about the circumstance you are in. And if that person you are looking at and about to say that to said that exact same thing in that kind of way to you, how would you feel? If it is not uplifting and it does not do good or does not help the situation, just don't say it. Just don't say it. You know, and when you're hearing what feedback people are giving you, take it through your heart, filter it, understand the fact that their understanding comes from their experience, you know. So they may be giving you a broken understanding because that's the broken person that they are. I love my father. I love him, man. But it took me years to understand that he loved me to the capacity that that broken man's love could. Like to the best, to the absolute best of his capacity from the broken life he had, from the broken family he came from and things like that, you know? So that's, it's a heart of compassion and understanding that there is no unchipped china in the shop.
Right.
There's none.
Right.
Everything's got a chip, a crack you can't see, an imperfection, something somewhere, everything.
Right. Exactly.
And
beautiful.
In the last few minutes, Anne, how can people begin that process of kind of taking a step back on both sides, both experiencer and family member of experiencer? How can they both begin to take a step back and process things a little bit differently?
Gosh. Speaking from just myself, because obviously I can't speak from any other, absolutely. You know, I would say look at it with curiosity, look at it with love, and ask, what is it trying to teach me? Mm-hmm. I think that would be the number one thing, because whether it was this really beautiful experience, whether it was a terrifying experience, try to learn about the ways that it affected you in the moment, the domino effect that it had.
Yep.
See, you know, where the lesson is, and just try to, as you said, you know, filter it through your heart. I mean, that's the best, you know, the best way. And that's how I've approached it, especially taking certain things to therapy. You know, why would my brain construct this, or, you know, what other avenues could there be? So openness as well. So like I said, curiosity and heart centered, and just being willing to be humbled and continue to be that eternal student. Drop the defense, drop the walls if you can, you know, that doesn't serve any purpose.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And you know, it's interesting because most people get defensive because the way in which a question has been asked.
Yes.
So on behalf of those curious, unpoint the question, blunt it, you know, you don't have to be confrontational in the way a question is asked.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah, it's hard. It's not easy. It's not easy asking an open-ended question. It's not easy receiving an answer with an open-ended receipt, you know, where it's like you still have an open mind. You're still willing to just accept prima facie what you've been told and have to dig no deeper, you know?
Right, right. Well, a lot of people deal with ambiguity and tolerance as well. So also being willing to accept that there might not be an answer.
Yeah.
And just, you know, some things will reveal themselves in time. So just being willing to accept peace.
Absolutely. Well, and we should do a whole episode just on ambiguity and tolerance.
I'm down.
Because in all sincerity, man. In all sincerity, it's one of those like, yeah. Because it goes into many, many sides of UFO, UAP, cryptozoology, paranormal, things like that.
Oh, yeah.
People get very, very upset that there is no answer, you know. Mm-hmm. And it's one of those like, you know, we don't really have an answer for God either.
Yeah.
But look at him go.
Right? Look, exactly. Yeah.
Everybody still goes to church on a Sunday, despite the unquantifiable of God, capital G, you know. Interesting things, interesting things. And thank you so much for your time, as always. Before we let you go, let everybody know where they can go to follow everything that is Ann Selene.
Oh, goodness. Well, my brand new incredible website, AnnSelene.com, is definitely the one-stop shop for all your Ann Selene needs.
That's right. That's right. You actually do, for anybody out there curious, yes, Ann does do private sessions, things like that, energy healing, you know, all kinds of things.
Yeah, intuitive life coaching type, you know, discussions, intuitive tarot, you know, like you said, Reiki and energy healing and everything.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, once again, Ann, thank you as always for your time. It's always great chatting with you, always great talking with you and diving into these very deep, deep things that have to do with our psychology, our spirituality, and our experiences of the paranormal. So. Thanks
it's
again.
Been an honor.
Always a pleasure. Hold the line real quick while we close things out. While you are online, checking out everything from the amazing Ann Selene at AnnSelene.com. Everybody, make sure to stop on by Curious Realm. Curious Realm is where you can like, follow, subscribe. That is where you can find all of the videos from our guest video pages on YouTube, as well as our events page. If you want to find a one-stop shop, folks, for all of the events that we cover, like PsyGames, like there are all of the interviews from PsyGames this year, Roswell UFO conference, everything else, that is the easiest way to find all of the playlists for every conference that we cover. And of course, do not forget Curious Research. CuriousResearch.org is where you can get your copy of the Field Observation and Encounter Log. And in addition, our all new protocol, Awakening Together. This is basically a anonymous self-help group for experiencers of the paranormal. If you would like to start your own group meetings, things like that, this is a non-judgmental, no advice allowed, non-religious, non-political atmosphere where anybody can share their experience and get support from other experiencers. Stop on by. We have the six pillars there, as well as all of the protocols for running meetings, everything else, how to make that kind of stuff happen. So stop on by, check it out, get your community meetings going now so that we can all help each other experience the paranormal in a different way and take those experiences into a deeper place in our life, because that's what it's all about. Thank you so much, everybody, as always, for your time. Thank you so much for your open hearts, your open minds. That is what makes the conversation. And without the conversation, humanity does not march forward. So remember, take care of yourselves, take care of each other, and stay curious. We'll talk to you soon. Bye-bye.
Thank you for tuning into this episode of The Curious Realm. Stay tuned for more guests, forbidden topics, and hidden truths. Follow us on social media by searching Curious Realm. To download the official Curious Realm app and view the Knowledge Vault, or become a sponsor of Curious Realm, visit our website at CuriousRealm.com. Curious Realm is available on your favorite podcast and video services, CuriousRealm.com, as well as KGRA Radio, APR TV, and the official Curious Realm app for Roku devices. Curious Realm is a proud member of the Ground Zero Media family of podcasts. For more shows and members-only content, visit GroundZeroPlus.com today. Thanks for listening. Stay curious, and remember, the other side is always watching.